So we're going to start by invoking Padmasambhava. Earlier today we did that, so we'll do it again. Dasani is going to chant it, and then I'm going to lead call and response. You all got your hymn sheets with you?
Mm-hmm.
It's call and response anyway, so it's just in case you get stuck. So Dasani is going to sing in Tibetan and Wunner, and then I'll do the call and response. Northwest of the land of Urgyan.
In the northwest of the land of Urgyan.
On the heart of a lotus blossom.
On the heart of a lotus blossom.
The wondrous one has attained the supreme city.
The wondrous one has attained the supreme city.
And is renowned as a lotus-born Padmasambhava.
And is renowned as a lotus-born Padmasambhava.
O you who are surrounded.
O you who are surrounded.
By an entourage of Dakinis.
By an entourage of Dakinis.
Following in your footsteps, I will work.
Following in your footsteps, I will work.
I beseech you to come.
I beseech you to come.
And grant your blessings.
And grant your blessings.
Guru Padma.
Guru Padma.
Siddhi Hum.
Siddhi Hum.
That was fun. Okay, I'm going to talk about this thing, this picture, and the significance. It's always a case of Padmasambhava, it's always, you can get away in with the pictures, yeah. The other sides of the Dharma and Buddhist teachings, you get in with the concepts or in with the word things, but in this, Padmasambhava is very much a visual being. I've got a stack of hundreds of cards here, and they're all different forms of Padmasambhava, and it's like a whole world. But so what are you supposed to do with this, yeah? You know, you look in the bookshop or in various festival days, you'll see different pictures coming up, and you can sort of think, what's that supposed to be? I don't understand that. What am I supposed to do with that? First of all, it's an icon. Yeah, I always like this. It's a computer icon. Yeah, so you've got the original icon is the Greek Orthodox icons of the Virgin Mary or Jesus, but the modern icon is a little thing, and you click on it, and a whole file opens up, doesn't it? And then you can click on one of them, and then you go, and then you go, and then you go, right? So this, if you click on it, it opens into a world, yeah? So first of all, it's an icon. It's like a door into a deeper reality. One of my favourite things I've been watching the last 2 years is Andrew Graham Dixon doing the early Orthodox Church and the paintings. There's three programmes on an iPlayer. I found him last night. And he spends a lot of time looking at Byzantine stuff and about how you get somebody who still paints these things in Athens. And works out the perspective. Now, what we were used to seeing, we're used to looking through a window at a thing, yeah? Objects in the material world, object, there we are. With a Greek icon, the perspective is back to front, and you are in the painting, the doorway. Yeah? So this is what this is. This is why the frames are on the side, yeah? Of a tanker. If you get a proper tanker, there's a little bit of extra cloth that's been sewn in at the bottom. And that's like a door. Yeah? So it's something you step into. It's not something you sit and observe or possess or have there. It's like a modern piece of art. It's a way in. So first of all, it's an icon. It's to be entered, not to be gawped at. Yeah? We can't look at it in the same way as we look at a photograph or things, other things we're used to. So it's visual dharma. Yeah? If you remember, one of the first books in Tibetan Buddhism was Tibetan Buddhist art was Chogyam Trungpa's. It's a catalogue to an exhibition, I think it's called Visual Dharma. It was like, it really got me thinking, like, this was Dharma, as much as the Eightfold Path, as much as the Four Noble Truths, as much as all the lovely conceptual lists and things. You have a whole side of Buddhism which is pictures, yeah? And it's communicating through visual form. And like conceptual Dharma, it's to be practiced, yeah? So if you come across something and think, oh, these are just nice notions, or what's this all about, or is this just clutter? And it's just getting away in my life, then think, how do I enter it? Can I use this? Can I practice this? Yeah, and there's a totally different relation, isn't it, to what is this thing that's getting in the way of me? What can I do with it? So try applying it, try practicing it. And both the visual dharma and the conceptual dharma are practices. Yeah? Everything in Buddhism is a doing. Yeah? It's not a static thing. This is something you do. Yeah? It's a tool for transformation. Yeah? So it's not an ornament. It's handy using the word tool because you do get people, I'm a bit like myself, like you collect screwdrivers or you collect different tools, yeah? and you forget the fact that you're supposed to make something with it. Yeah? Yeah. So I've got hundreds of pictures of Padmasambhava, you know, collecting and collecting, and books as well. Joy Patchen keeps, she's my pusher. Keeps telling me new, more and more books that order through wisdom, you know. And it's like, you know, one or two I've practiced a bit, but if I practiced like that much to the shelf, I'd be quite a different person. But I keep collecting more. So same with the pictures. You use them, you don't collect them. It's a mirror, yeah? All icons, all things are mirrors. And usually, see that shape? It's a bit like a person meditating. So you can see this is what you're like when you're meditating, what's going on here. Yeah? You're sitting there practicing. You can see this as a way of seeing yourself. Just like the wheel of life is the bad news. This is both the bad news and the good news we're getting into. This is the wheel of life and Aranyaka's mandala that's now above where the person leads the puja. It's a mirror of your potential and what you've got to do about it. Yeah? So it's a mirror and a door into a deeper apprehension of life. It's an address to you. Yeah? It's all the same. Religious things aren't just put out there by chance. They're addressed to you in particular. Yeah? It's your vision. Yeah? So Padmasambhava, what was my introduction to Padmasambhava? It was 23 years ago. That's proof it was 2 years ago. 25 years ago, I'd reread the Three Jewels. I tell this to everybody in every talk. Actually, I was going through notes that came out of this folder of Padmasambhava readings, and it was a little set of notes of just a little short talk I was giving before a puja, maybe last year, a year before, and written on that was everything I've put on this talk. And it goes back to the thing that sort of people only give the same talk. It's sort of like, it's always the same talk. So this is my talk coming again, yeah? So you've probably heard this loads of times, but I was reading the Three Jewels, Sanganaksha's book, the second time, reading about the leaf changing colour, and there being no such thing as leaf beyond the change, and a thing went click in my head, and that was me, a Buddhist. And this is profound, profound perspective that couldn't be bettered. You know, I tried to run away from it and avoid it and pretend it wasn't happening and everything since, but that kind of was that on that level. And that was me down in the summer, I don't know if it was shearing sheep or driving tractors on the farm. But then I came back here, and it was Padmasambhava Day, September, August, October, sometime in there. And the shrine was all done up with bones and red things and fire and Padmasambhava pictures all over the place. And there was readings like the ones you've heard this afternoon of you know, this very kind of elusive, subtle, magical world that is in the Padmasambhava stories. And I went, oh yeah, this is great. All that perspective, all that view and pictures as well and stories as well and all this is going to sign me up. You know, so that was these first moments are quite important, and then we come across and something really clicked. So that was Padmasambhava, that was me kind of sold. You know, Padmasambhava has always been a sort of cornerstone. Yeah. Took up the sadhana when I got ordained 15 years ago, but you start your sadhana before, way before, don't know if you're ever going to do it. You start it really early. You've got a draw to a Tara or Padmasambhava or something, and that kind of builds up. So that was me started. So yeah, it was another side. It wasn't just the word side or the conceptual side. That kind of language, it was a visual and a legendary and something that gets under another angle. So the figure of Padmasambhava, stuck him up here. He's a lotus born. Padmasambhava means lotus born. And there's lots of different life stories of him. Some he's born as a normal human being in a normal way. Some he flies out the sky and lands in a lotus, all sorts of ways. This is like him coming out of this is a loch, yeah? The loch of Dhanakosha. He's actually born in the loch of Dhanakosha. That's what Dhanakosha is named after. Is a lake in somewhere, wherever it is, Punjab, Afghanistan, Pakistan. There's this legendary valley which got lost, and that's where Padmasambhava was born. And here he is. He's got on three robes. He's got a Vajrayana robe, a Theravada basic Buddhism robe, and he's got a Mahayana robe. So he's got a lot, yeah? He's been initiated into the whole works of all the Buddhism that Indian culture developed, that Indian Buddhism developed. He's got a hat. A king tried to set him on fire and then got very upset because he couldn't burn them and decided to give up the ghost and say sorry and gave him his kingdom. And that's the hat he gave him. She's got a vulture's feather. The yogi wears a vulture's feather. Vultures fly the highest, biggest bird. You know, it flies in the wild on using the wind's energies. Like a meditator uses the energies of the mind and the heart. Yogi feather. A big staff. He's probably stolen this from Shiva. There we go. A trident. If you go to Ainster, that's what Fife people call it, isn't it? Foreigners call it Ainster, I don't know what it means. Yeah, Ainster is the Fife pronunciation, yeah. And there's a fisheries museum. And you go in there, and it goes this amazing, fascinating stuff about the history of fishery and fishing in Scotland. And there's a whole row of gaffs, as we call them, things that you catch fish with. And they're fearsome weapons, big barbed things that go everywhere. And some of them look very much like this. And what he does with that is he gets and stirs the depths. Digs up scary things out of the depths. Yeah. He has a vajra, a diamond thunderbolt, truth itself, in one hand. In the other hand, he has a skull cup. So I'm going to pass around this. He has a skull sitting in his, held close to him, close to his heart, close to his body, as a symbol for death. I'm going to pass this around and get the feel for it. I've got one here. One I made earlier. I watch teeth might fell out. I don't think this chap was too healthy. He's got a thin face, so watch the teeth don't fall out when you're passing it around. Get the feel for that. I don't know. They used to get brought in from like Pakistan, India, and things like that, isn't it?
Was it not Yorick?
Alas, I knew him, Horatio. Yeah. Well, it's death, isn't it? He has this active truth, this diamond thunderbolt, and he's holding, in the passive side, that the left-hand side of his body, he's holding close to him the fact that there is death. And held in the bowl is a little vase of the elixir of life. Yeah. So this is what you do when you take up a sadhana. You spend years thinking skull, defeat, loss, and immortality in the same hand. Yeah. And that just grows over the years. Yeah. No easy solutions to that one, but there it is. Yeah. And he's got one foot up and one foot down. Yeah, one foot is in deepest meditation and one foot steps out. And that was important for me because it's like he's reaching into the world. And the figures I've been drawn to, Green Tara and Padmasambhava, they're reaching to us. And I always think, like, he's a patron saint of no-hopers like me. Yeah. I can't manage all these really refined beings that sit very elevated and withdrawing in pure white and everything, but the ones that are prepared to muddle in and get down to my level, I have a hope with. It's just something like, you know, these patron saints, no hopers, will come and pick me up. Was it St. Anthony's Lost Causes? Is it St. Jude? Yeah, well, he's the St. Jude of Buddhism. He's going to come down, no matter how bad I get, he'll still be there, ready to pull me out. And he's got a look in his face that matters to me. Yeah, he's got this eyebrows, cross eyebrows, and a really compassionate smile. And he reminds me of my Uncle Rab. my father's brother. There's a whole group of them, especially Uncle Rab. This kind of like, he's a bit of the black sheep of the family, a bit of a rogue. I grew up with them, working with big scary cows and things. And like, they would kind of challenge you. Yeah, my father would do this and Uncle Rab would do this as well. Like, be able to work this big scary animal, be a master of this big scary animal. And I'm trying to learn, I'm terrified, you know. And they're not going to have it easy in letting me off the hook. But for my own good, they want me to learn and be able to cope with this thing. And a cow, these black Irish cows we used to have, it was just giving birth, and they were a mass of hormones. Yeah, they made, is it PMT getting out of it? What's the modern language for it? That's nothing. This is the thing that I would roll up, and you had to go and tie this thing up. And it was all blah, and froth at the mouth. And it's something about kind of stern, but at the same time kind, attitude of, you know, not getting off the hook, you're not getting away with this, you've got to do this, but they'll be there in the way. And that to me was like what Padmasambhava's face was. Yeah? It was a challenge. It was a compassionate challenge rather than as kind of palliative or that side of it. So that's figure and what it meant to me and how he caught me. History and myth. The history is somewhere in Tibet in history, there's a period where Buddhism arrives and Padmasambhava was in the records as coming out of India, having mastered a lot of stuff and coming out of India and being really important in spreading Buddhism in Tibet. But it grows, the story grows, like King Arthur was probably a Celtic 8th century Christian, you know, what became Welsh chieftain, but it becomes much more, doesn't it? The stories build, and Padmasambhava builds and becomes, he embodies all the Dharma, all of Buddhism, all of that initiating of Buddhism into a new society, into transforming, into converting, into engaging with the depths and turning them around. And usually the story is of Padmasambhava building, the people before Padmasambhava trying to build a monastery, a big temple, and establish Buddhism in Tibet, and all the demons come out, big dragon serpents and scary things come out and take all the walls away at night. And then Padmasambhava arrives, he gets brought in to rebuild and stop this, so he converts those demons and those naga spirits. He communicates on their level in a language and converts them. And the usual story, as is most stories in Padmasambhava, most talks you get in the Ahtavio, it's all about you start meditating, everything's lovely and well, it's all quite reasonable, and then it stirs up the depths, doesn't it? And whoa, all hell literally breaks loose, yeah? And then you need Padmasambhava, you need a whole other level of practice. But that's another talk that'll be next year. Yeah, that's the other one. So he's a symbol for transformation. He's the initiator of the Dharma, a kind of guru, if you like. He's kind of like where you receive the Dharma from. And he becomes a force of Dharma practice itself. There's eight forms he takes in which they represent every aspect of Buddhist personality. So there's the teacher, the monk, there's the wrathful yogi that lives in the wild deeps of the forest. There's the householder king living out his duties in the world. There's archetypal figures like the Buddha himself and the absolute Buddha and wrathful figures. He gradually grows into, he forms every, covers all the areas. It becomes like the Dharma itself. So when you look at Padmasambhava, the three ropes are kind of that as well. It's not just a historical figure. The people that follow his school would see him as Buddhism. Maybe the way we see Shakyamuni. And he's important to us. We celebrate him because Sangha actually met him in Kalimpong in a statue and opened the door and went into this temple and something happened. He saw this figure and from then on he had a deep connection with this figure. And most of his teachers tended to come from the school, the Nyingma school, a fair number of them, who carried Padmasambhava's tradition down to the present day. So we've got a connection through that. You can read the books, you can read the life and liberation texts, which are like Dharma, but Dharma as epic action movie, yeah? Sort of Peter Jackson number, yeah? With a screenplay by Alan Moore, maybe, a score, the music in the background would be Black Sabbath, or heavy prog, or a nice piece of Scandinavian melodic black metal, yeah? Daphne's been, I've been catching up as well, working her way through a box set of Buffy. And it's like, if you watch that, you get a feel. It's a kind of nice, light American teen version, you know, of taking on all sorts of demons and turning them and transforming them around. And that's the language it uses in these texts. You get different ones. You get some that are really wild and some that are a bit more calmer and a bit more rational. So they're all about sort of like Padmasambhava. In a way, he's an upsetter of tyrants. He goes through India, he goes through Tibet, he goes into a situation where there is oppression and tyranny and somebody that's ego run mad and he just stirs it, he breaks it. He goes into the most difficult situation and turns it around, breaks up that. He's a hero that appears again and again wherever it's needed, yeah, in order to establish a true Dharma practice. And I always associate that sort of behaviour. Like Magnificent Seven is one of my favourite movies. It's probably a guy thing, isn't it? But kind of to hear the music of Magnificent Seven and always be moved, you know? Getting into a situation and sorting out Eli Wallach. Is it Eli Wallach? He sort of takes over. He's a bandit, isn't he? And he's got this terrible iniquity and situation going on. And there's seven of them. It's usually Padmasambhava's own, marches into the situation. And sometimes he gets tied up and they try to set fire to him or they try to bury him and everything. But he always outdoes them to the sheer power of practice and turns it around. The king converts, the king collapses, the pride crumbles before the Dharma. Yeah, he's about the Dharma thriving in the most difficult circumstances. I'm going back, me and Daphne hope to get in February back to India and going up to a lake up in Himachal Pradesh, which is north of the Punjab, where Tibetan tradition believe this is where Padmasambhava got caught, tied up and set fire to. And it's just this lake now. It's a bit like a kind of a lake in a Scottish or a British park. It's all got nice walk around it and everything. It's all very kind of reasonable like. But it's here that you're supposed to have like been tried to be set fire to and survived it. And that's the title of this talk, The Lotus Blossoming Amidst the Fire. I got the idea, the title, when I did this talk before, from Thich Nhat Hanh's book. One of his first books was The Lotus and the Sea of Fire. And it's all about him and his movement practicing Buddhism in 60s Vietnam, which is like, you know, we've got it really easy. These people have been assassinated and they're trying to practice Buddhism and trying to make Buddhism socially relevant and relevant to citizenship. We're caught between the pro-American backed Catholic regime, which were oppressing Buddhism, and the communists that went much better. So he was, his Buddhism was the lotus, principles of the Dharma, in the midst of a real fire, a real social fire, a real terrible situation. So I've nabbed that story for Padmasambhava. So Padmasambhava goes through all his adventures, goes to Tibet, he's really instrumental in converting Buddhism from the heights and the depths towards Buddhist practice. And then, when he's got everything just as best he can manage, he's always telling the Tibetans off, I've been rubbish at this and rubbish at that, but the best he can manage, he gets on a horse, sometimes a blue horse, sometimes a blue flying horse, and shoots off. Yeah, proper heroic ending, flies off to the southwest. And where he's going is here. He's going to this place, he's going to a copper coloured mountain on an island of cannibals. Yeah. And this is Padmasambhava's Pure Land. So Pure Land is where the central figure in a Buddhist image becomes the whole environment. You have Amitabha, who's the Buddha of the West, Buddha of compassion, of love, of meditation, of the glowing red setting sun. And the Western Pure Land is like a whole world, which is the objective reflex of his qualities. Is Sukhavati, the happy land, yeah, the happy place. It's flat, it's lapis lazuli, everything's made of jewels. Beings sit around in the most perfect conditions and just practice. And if you can't get enlightened straight off, go there and you'll just have perfect conditions. Yeah. This is a perfect retreat centre. Yeah. The jewel trees just blow in the wind and you hear impermanence, insubstantiality, unsatisfied. That's the sound that the rustling leaves make. Yeah. So you're guaranteed, get there, no problem, enlightened in a week, probably. Yeah. This is Padmasambhava's. What he's got is a fortress. And inside the fortress, there's harmonious practitioners getting on with their practice. There's a moat, and then there's lots of rakshasas, cannibals, eating each other, tearing guts out, skinning each other, being a little horrible little tyrants to each other, haven't you? It's not, you think, Padmasambhava's got a terrible Pure Land. Amitabha's got a lovely peaceful one, and he's got some sort of half-baked one, yeah? And you think, it's not a good one. How come he's got such a pure one? It's because he's a bad practitioner, not as good as Amitabha. If you look closely, though, you have what's called the Palace of Lotus Light, with Amitabha sitting in the middle of it. So Sukhavati, yeah? The symbol for the goal of Buddhism, yeah? For that completely perfect situation, is in the heart of a world which is going in a completely different direction. So Amitabha's Pure Land, Sukhavati, is the result of transformation. And Padmasambhava's Pure Land is the very point of transformation. Yeah? It's the very act. Yeah? It's the point of transformation into the goal. It's the goal and the path, if you like. Yeah? Padmasambhava is the path. Padmasambhava is that very transformative, dynamic point of change of the worst meeting the best. And Amitabha is the end result of that. I always think it was like James Bond and M. Yeah? Like Amitabha's M and sends Padmasambhava out on a mission. Yeah? And this is his pretty tough one. It's even worse than Goldfinger or all the other baddies with the white cat. And I keep thinking of Dr. No now. That's a different Dr. No. Dr. No, who's the comedian one?
Oh, yeah.
Austin Powers baddie. What's he called? Dr. Evil, is it? Yeah. So it's a symbol of an attitude to practice. Yeah, it's Dharma practice as a momentum of creativity. And this attitude is quite crucial. This is the first, think this is the first nugget I've got in getting into this doorway, what I come across first of all, is when you're sitting meditating, having an attitude of, right now, you're the best person for this meditation. Yeah? You can't be anybody else. You can't be doing anything else. Yeah? This moment, in this meditation, this afternoon with Diana Ross and, was it Smokey? I was horrified that I recognised Smokey. And all these songs, that beat, Don't Worry, Be Happy, we're blasting, if you want to hear this afternoon, we're blasting down from above. Right? And it's not like, oh, I'll wait till this, if only this music could stop, I'd have a perfect meditation. But it's like, what is happening right now? What can I do right now? This is a perfect situation to practice with all the music coming from above, whatever's happening right now. Yeah. So it's like it happens here, not over in some Western paradise, or when this gets sorted out, or that gets sorted out, or when the kids get a bit older, or you manage to get retired, or have this thing sorted out. How can you do it right now? Yeah. Wherever you go, there you are. Kabat-Zinn book, wherever you go, there you are. And that moment, what can you do? This is Padmasambhava. At this moment, what can you do? If you remember Bimala Vajra when he started off his hill walk retreats, he got them, take people up a big mountain and get up there to shout, I'm going to die, what am I going to do about it? Yeah. Unlike legend. So, what are you going to do about it? Yeah. Here you are, what are you going to do about it? Yeah. So, the story it's carried in this is that the fruits of practice are not at the end of a hard struggle. Yeah. Well, the positive engagement itself, point one. So in the Sangha, harmony isn't the absence of conflict, yeah, but it's the resolution of conflict. Mm-hmm. It's the active, ongoing commitment of meeting conflict and resolving it. Yeah. Generosity is its own reward. You know, a weird thing you can get in Buddhism sometimes is you do this deed, that deed, and that deed so you can get goodies at the end or a nice rebirth. Yeah. But that's not quite the story, is it? Generosity is the reward. Yeah. The very act of spiritual practice is the fruit. Yeah. Yeah. This is Padmasambhava's pure land, is moving from somewhere over there that's perfect to perfecting, yeah, moving it to dynamic. And Padmasambhava embodies this positive engagement. Yeah. Not a distant thing called enlightenment, but an ever enlightening momentum. Yeah. It's moving from seeing a thing called enlightenment to actions of enlightening. As good as it gets, another one of my favourite phrases I use every week. A Jack Nicholson movie, isn't it? Mm-hmm. I can't remember much about the movie. It was funny in bits, but the title was brilliant, isn't it? But a certain attitude of, this is as good as it gets. Yeah. And then you can have a Bimala Vajra thing, what am I going to do about it? Yeah. This is as good as it gets. What have we got in there? Every moment is as good as it gets. That's an important aspect of mindfulness, of paying attention. Yeah. When you get right into a breath, it's every breath, isn't it? When you're really into the metta, that person is every person. There's something about that Blakean moment when a moment becomes everything. Yeah. Was it the world in a grain of sand, an eternity in an hour? You can think the end of the world and not get that, but you can sometimes feel it really immediately, can't you? If you can pay attention to one moment, then you know that the whole rest of the world is like that. It's made up of lots more moments just like that. Everywhere else is just made up of more of this. Yeah, this is it, and time is running out. The human body at peace with itself is more precious than the rarest gem. Cherish this body, it is yours this one time only. The human form is one with difficulty, it is easy to lose. All worldly things are brief, like lightning in the sky. This life you must know as a tiny splash of beauty that disappears even as it comes into being. Therefore, set your goal, make use of every day and night to achieve it. So when you do a lot of Padmasambhava, reading around Padmasambhava, there's a stuff about Tantra, and it can get very grand and distant, and you have to be initiated up to the armpits before you can understand it. But part of the gist right behind Tantra is, okay, all this talk, all this stuff, where is it now? Find it now. When you're sitting doing a puja with that attitude, it's like, you are the Buddha, you are the Bodhisattvas. The sevenfold puja is you're acting as if. Yeah? You're in a ritual theatre, if you like, of acting as if. It's method acting. Yeah? For this moment, you are being the Bodhisattva going through the puja. And just in case we get mad and egotistic, you give it away at the end and you don't take it by. Yeah? That's important. But. So, cannibals. Here they all are. some little tyrants on the little thrones with their fawning followers sitting around them. And some are having a really terrible time getting eaten, and some are eating others. There's one with horns and a funny face. It's great, having a great time, as cannibals do. It's a situation of codependence going on here, yeah? So there's superiors and inferiors, and the ones who are big bosses, and the ones who are underneath fawning, and you're mutually dependent in a situation where they need the other to be in that role. But they've got to watch out, yeah? The tyrants make one slip, and they're dinner. And the next one comes up, yeah? Gordon Brown's got it lucky. He'll just have to get to spend more time with his family, but you know, whoever takes over from him. But these ones, they pay the ultimate price. So a cannibal is a lovely image, isn't it? Let's go into that. It's an icon. Let's go into that. Exploitation at its most visceral. Yeah, you don't just abuse somebody or slight somebody or prejudice somebody. You eat them. Yeah. Actually eating people. A society where everybody and everything is seen in terms of how they can be used. Yeah. So we live in a society very much like that. And I'm going to read Allen Ginsberg. Lovely, I've got a soft spot for Allen Ginsberg. Not really the whole poem, but I'm just going to... I was reading, wandering through the net, as I do endlessly for hours, searching to consume, and I come across actual voice stuff of Allen Ginsberg. So, come on, pigs of Western civilization, eat more greed. Yeah. Eat more marbled sirloin, more pork and gravy. Lard up the dressing, fry chicken in boiling oil, carry it dribbling to grey climes snowed with salt. Little lambs covered with mint roast and racks, surrounded by roast potatoes wet with butter sauce. Buttered veal medallions and creamy saliva, buttered beef. By glistening mountains of French fries, stroganoffs and white hot sour cream chops soaked in olive oil, surrounded by olive, salty feta cheese, followed by Roquefort and Blue and Stilton, thirsty for wine, beer, Coca-Cola, Fanta, champagne, Pepsi, Ritzina, Arak, whiskey, vodka, ag, watch out heart attack, pop more angina pills, and so on. If you want how to pronounce and speak out poetry, then listen to some of that. He's got this brilliant ability to deliver. And it's all summed up with George Romero movies. Zombie movies? I'm a fan of zombie movies. Yep, one.
You should get together.
We do. Buffy, and then Evil Dead, and then Night of the Dead. Shaun of the Dead's a good one. George Romero, that's why it's such a hit, isn't it? The zombie movies, you've got, the second movie is Dawn of the Dead, apparently, and it's set in a shopping mall. Yeah, can you get a better image? A shopping mall, yeah, where we just go and we just hungrily, not brains, but handbags or whatever it is, yeah? And it's taken over by zombies, yeah? And it all comes back to the trap and where we are, and the trap of relating to life as our experience. If you get a chance, listen to Sangha Raksha's talk, Enlightenment as Experience and Non-Experience. It's part of three that's in the book, A Taste of Freedom. And he's been going through it with us in the Mitra conveners at Pavloka. And the next one in November is going to be that one. I'm quite shocked. It's one of my favourites. Sangha Raksha in that talks about enlightenment as non-experience and experience. But have a listen to that. It's equivalent to Chogyam Trungpa's Cutting Through Spiritual Materialism, which is all about this. Yeah. So we've got our experience, haven't we? And we go and we have experience. We pay for experience. People have been turning up at Loch Lomond for hundreds of years experiencing Loch Lomond. Yeah? You fall in Loch Lomond, you experience it quite vividly. You look at it, you swim on it, you fish in it, whatever. But they've built the Loch Lomond experience there now, which is a big facility. You go in and you buy things. Yeah? You probably never get near the water, but you go and you have the Loch Lomond experience all put on for you. Yeah? They've packaged and presented Loch Lomond in a consumable that costs money. Yeah, the Loch Lomond, and it's full of that. You can have that new thing in Lanarkshire or something, the mining experience or a heritage thing, it's all packaged and presented back to you. And we're reduced to a passive consumer. I don't know if the rest of you get annoyed when you're on a train and you're a consumer now, you're not a passenger, you're not a patient in a hospital, you're not a citizen in terms of legal stuff and such like, and political stuff, you're not an active participant anymore, you're a consumer. Yeah. We're sort of trained more and more to become passive, like baby birds, you know, baby birds. That's what it does. And something kind of stops it down you and feeds you. Yeah? And everything's reduced to a basic commercial package, an enticing surface presentation, yet mere image, a commodity. It's the anniversary of 68, isn't it? And that was one of the situationists with the whole revolution that was happening. Capitalism turns everything into a commodity, a consumable, yeah? And McDonald's is the best, right? So they go, and they're probably maybe German descendants, but they have, in Germany, you have lots of things, sausage, ways of preserving meat that gets put in between bits of some kind of bread and eaten. And what McDonald's did was abstracted that, took it into a basic, presentable package, and then sold it. And the thing doesn't taste of much, does it? But it looks that important, doesn't it? Coke's the same, a sugar and water mixed together, and you buy the inside and the outside, don't you? You buy this commodity, it's packaged. And it's like, I'm rushing a bit mad here, but I'll keep going. Independence Day, the big spaceships, you know that? Basically, they're locusts, aren't they? They're intergalactic locusts who move on to a new planet, eat it, and move on. And so these big corporations can be like that, society can be like finding something, consuming it, taking it and abstracting it to the basic principles, packaging it and selling it out again. So you've got food being reduced to McDonald's and their ilk. Sex is reduced to pornography. Art is reduced to Brit art, people like Damien Hirst and the Turner Prize. Politics is reduced to party political spin and focus groups. And religion is reduced to best-selling platitudinous reassurance. I'm proud of that line. Religion is reduced to best-selling platitudinous reassurance. Yeah. Impotent, consumable, packaged, isolated commodities. So it might be particularly rife today, but it's not just a symptom of the degenerate modern capitalist age. Romantics like me have to watch out for this because I tend to think, well, lovely past, yeah. Native Americans, Siberian shamans, medieval things, monastic traditions, Tibetans. I can tend to think, well, maybe they're the perfect thing. It's all been ruined by the modern capitalist age, but they were at it, yeah. Every Tibetan lama had tons of serfs, yeah, had all sorts of things. It's a constant, it's in there. We're particularly good at it, man, on a big scale. But the cannibals, the Rakshasas, have always been around. Take a dog, yeah? It's a basic, ancient thing. It goes right back to dogs. So a dog's walking along the street, right? Sniffing, identifying, yeah? And it comes across. What it's doing is it, can I eat it or shag it? Yeah? And it goes, yep, I can. And the tail wags, right? That's desire. Yeah, very basic. Sorry, I'm a bit visceral there, but that's quite basic, right? And then it goes, oh, can that eat me? Oops. And then the hackles come up, don't it? And it's like this, and it's hate. So you've got desire, you've got hate, and then is it of no use to me? Ignore it. And that's ignorance, yeah? Central view of life, yeah? Vedana part, like, dislike, neutrality, and then the grasping, right at the root of existence. Not just the modern age. And here's the GBC in Sucky Hall Street. Yeah, here we are in the centre. In the midst of a consumer world of bars, clubs and shops. Yeah. This whole street, if you did all night sit in the West Side, you hear the riot going outside. And everybody's packaged, don't they? They're going to come in, and then there's bars you start off with, and then you work your way up to the clubs, and then you get so drunk you come out, it's all the fast, greasy food you eat, and there's big taxi ranks, you get lined up and pushed in. And it's this production line, like the sausage factory in Kwanaskansi, if you remember that, just doodle, interposed between people and sausages. But that's, and then that night when it snowed, didn't it? And it broke, the conveyor belt broke, and the taxis couldn't get in. And there was thousands of people in Sucky Hall Street. The whole packaging, processing thing broke down, and people couldn't get out of it. They all had to go and sleep, and the whole thing, they had to go back into the clubs and sleep on the floor and everything. And here we are in the middle of this, yeah? And the danger is that we can be seen and see ourselves as another shop selling another product. Yeah. So that's a horizontal matter of choice between the cinema or a meditation class. Yeah. Bar Buddha's like that, isn't it? There's all these Buddhas sitting in there. But it's a place you drink. The Buddha doesn't have any significance like it does in the shrine. Maybe a better looking Buddha, but it means a lot less. So what we're working at in the centre is to help build this Thamasanga's palace looks like in the middle of a cannibal island, the middle of a city of consumption. That's what I'm doing here. It's about this high in my lounge. I'm asking us to put up with it, but it is in the lounge. And if I found, usually I'm describing, I'm seeing the council, Glasgow Buddhist Centre Council, vision days or such like, I'll just start ranting on about, I'm building Padmasambhava's castle in the middle of Carnival Island. That's the image of what I'm doing. Yeah, that's what we're trying to build. Yeah. We're building another order of relating, of people relating a different way, relating to each other on a completely different basis. Yeah. I'm on a mission from Padmasambhava. But what we're trying to do can be drawn in at any time. Yeah, it can be drawn in. The carnivals can draw you in to that language, can draw ourselves into that way of thinking. So I could be tempted right now in this talk to say things that please you just to get approval. I can say things just to make a joke and have you laugh, and I go, got something. Yeah? And you can be sitting listening, just taking in what you find reassuring, what you find suits you, what you find gives you that happy feeling, and ignoring the bits, or even wanting to destroy the bits. Yeah, responding with the greed, the hatred, the ignorance. Yeah. So I could be using buzzwords that give you a nice warm feeling. Yeah, this is a bit like Barack Obama. Yeah, I can say new hope, change, unity. I don't have to go much beyond that. And you all go, wait, whoa, yeah. Or if you're right winger, McCain's courage, safety, backbone. And you all go, wait, yeah. So let's try a game. Let's play it being at a political rally, right? So what you got to do is sit and be aware of yourself, yes. And be aware of the sensations of your body as you sit here. Yeah, you're doing that. Your thoughts, your responses, likes and dislikes. Notice how you're responding to what you're experiencing. And then I'm going to say some words, and when you hear words that you know you like, cheer, right? Pretend you're at one of these American rallies or something. Okay, right? The Glasgow Buddhist Centre strives to be inclusive. Accessible.
Yay.
Non-judgmental.
Yay.
Tolerant.
Yay.
Relevant to the person on the street.
Yay.
Okay, awakening.
Yay.
Interconnected.
Yay.
That's a good one. Freedom.
Yay.
Empty.
Yay.
Oh, right, that's interesting. Radical.
Yay!
I thought I wouldn't get a response. That's a 70s one, right? Prasangika Madhyamika.
Yay!
You all just say the same noise for everyone. We have no fixed self.
Yay!
All our bodies will age and die.
Yay!
Really? No experience can give us complete satisfaction.
Yay!
I didn't quite work the way I was expecting, though, right? But that's taken from an episode of Family Guy. Yeah. If you're watching fans of Family Guy, Lois. Lois becomes mayor by stopping making sense. She tries to make sense of this political rally. She stood up as mayor to get a cause done. Save a lake, isn't it? And she realises you can't speak reason to him, and starts coming up with buzzwords like terrorism and safety, and they all go, whoa, and she gets better than the mayor that's in and wins. Yeah. So that's where it could go wrong, yeah, in a talk, for example, in the right moment. Although you cheer equally with everyone, so back to drawing board with this one. Work on this one. Cannibal's inner, okay, at the heart of the matter, so I've been talking about society, yeah. About a way how we work collectively and using each other, using others in society and being consumable and consuming. But personally, right in the middle of our experience, is the greed, the hate and the delusion at the heart of the wheel of life, of our experience. Grasping and destroying in an attempt to fix identity, trying to grasp at the ever-changing, unfixable, elusive appearances. So the cannibal is the embody our attempt to limit, yeah, to fix the world our way, get it sorted in our terms, and thus we trap ourselves in a cage of limitation, yeah, and thus we suffer. We have a sense of lack. Beyond the basic, straightforward, biological pain, we've got this sense of not being quite what it is because we've trapped ourselves, we've shut ourselves off from the world, and then we feel isolated, lacking, yeah, And Michelle says, although we're trying to get it our way. That's the theory. The grasping heart. So I hope we don't actually eat each other. I hope we don't actually get up to that. Was it that Dow? Was it Dow? Was the guy, the famous American, Damer?
Yeah,
people. No,
okay,
there's very few of them, but on a subtle level, yeah, there's always little moments we dismiss, we blame, we use, we override another's wishes for our own ends, we even override our own wishes for others' ends. We diminish ourselves, yeah, diminish others. Always feeble attempts we have to try and fix the world, limit the world in our way. And this picture symbolises the tension between a grasping heart and the open, loving heart. Break open the loving heart. I think it's a chapter in Sharon Salzberg, isn't it? It's lovely, kind of breaking open a loving heart, letting that out. And metta is the very practice for that. Metta, what you're doing is you're moving, especially the neutral person, a difficult person, but even a friend, you're moving from seeing a person as a thing, as an object, to seeing them as a subject, another subject. Moving from seeing them as just a thing out there. Like I always introduce the metta bhavana, the neutral person is like, in the office, cheese plant, computer, water tank, person, another computer. There's not much difference in your response. But metta is seeing that person as they're looking back at you. Yeah? They have feelings, they have wants, they have basically the same things we have. And they're looking back as another experiencing human being. True nature is always elusive. Only the heart of no heart can grasp it. Up in the mountain, the burning jade stays brilliant, and in the roaring furnace, lotus blossoms keep their fragrance. So this is No An, Korean poem. Yeah. Only an open heart, only the heart of no heart, can grasp the true nature. And the grasped closing heart misses the opportunity and is stuck in suffering, stuck in the wheel of life. Abandon this fleeting world, abandon yourself, then the moon and flowers will guide you along the way. And this is expressed in ethics, yeah, how we live our lives, how we treat others, right back to the expression in our everyday through the precepts. Yeah. Samuel Johnson says, the true measure of a man is how he treats someone who can do him absolutely no good. Yeah. So like running a class and you think, oh, I must pay attention to the brightest, this instinct pays attention to the most Buddhist looking ones. Yeah. how am I going to spot that? But it's a general principle of like, all of them, everybody, each person, yeah, matters as much. Consuming the Dharma. Padmasambhava looks out, yeah, looks out from his fortress, and he understands the cannibals entirely. He knows everything they're doing, he knows why they do it, and what they'll do next. Yeah. The cannibals don't have a clue about Padmasambhava. And a cannibal king meets the Dharma, a bit like Tristan Detson reading this afternoon, meeting Padmasambhava. Yeah. And there's only two things a cannibal king can do. Try to use it for his own limited ends, like stick lots of statues of the Buddha in a pub and sell beer, or feel threatened by it and attempt to destroy it. So we wrongly grasp the Dharma by attempting to consume it. Yeah? We approach Buddhism and we pick out little bits that appeal, isolated bits, little consumable nuggets we can get an experience from to passively consume and grasp, rather than seeing it in its own terms. In its own vast context, as a means of changing us. Yeah? We can treat it as a flat thing that we can grasp rather than a doorway that we enter in that changes us. The difference between grasped and closed and open. So you have all these books, don't you? These Buddhist techniques that are adapted to form personal development schemes for business success. Or you get books on the Zen of relationships. And you just have to think of Hakkarin, you know, like the Zen master. He took over a monastery. And there's nobody there, it's so run down, it's only half a roof. And he lived in it, and worked in it, and started teaching and attracting people. And he's really tough, he attracted only the really hardest core, and gradually built up the whole roof. Yeah. He was living here through the snow, falling through half the roof of his temple he was living in. And the girl next door got pregnant, and gave birth to the child, and the parents were saying, who's the father? And eventually she goes, it was Hakkarin, this monk next door. And so they grab the child, they take it over and they give it to Hakkarin and go, there, you look after it. And he goes, tells all the big story, you daughter, is that so? He takes the child in, cares for it, gets a wet nurse, which would be easy in those days with so many child mortalities. Spends about a year or something bringing up the child, doing whatever he needs to do to bring up the child. And the girl next door can't stand it being part of my childhood, and lasts a year and goes, no, it wasn't him, it was him. And the parents storm in to Hackman's place, grabs the child back, tells them the other story, and goes away with it, and he says, is that so? That's personal fulfilment. Yeah. That's a personal attitude to life. You can read Tricycle magazine. You ever look at that? There's always adverts. Really expensive Tibetan statues and this kind of bowl and a proper Zen Zafu all the way from Okahama or wherever, you know. And it's like £300 each and dollars and this and dollars to that. And there's adverts for teachings that are quite similar. This very powerful Lama or this very powerful Zen abbot with all these empowerments and teachings and lineages. And all this big description of them as a commodity, as a thing you can buy for usually $300 or $400 for a weekend. It will be giving teachings. Now, teachings is almost irrelevant. It's this package presentation, this personality, this guru, this thing you can go and buy. Yeah? There's such a danger we can do that all the time. Buddhism gets drawn in, gets packaged, gets McDonaldized, doesn't it? Gets taken and turned into a commodity and then resold at fast bucks. Venerable Lama Chikawa, Tibetan mind training, like using a god for a demon, or using a Formula One car to go shopping, yeah. Using like Buddhism to sort out personal relationships or get a good job or something. Yeah. So there's always profound teachings ripe for the picking to be plucked out of context and used in little limited ways by our limited little minds. Yeah. Buddha nature, pure awareness, tantra, non-duality. Right, all these subtle teachings that work in a context, work in a package, yeah. And a broad structure of practice with safeguards that avoid misunderstanding, yeah, get taken out as a consumable item off the shelf. They can't be used as get out of jail card for the work you have to do. And Padmasambhava represents the whole package. That's why you get three robes. It represents all traditions of Buddhism, all phases of Indian Buddhism developed. The earliest phase, the Mahayana, the Tantra. He represents ethics, meditation, wisdom in all the levels. He represents the introduction into Tibet of a full Dharma practice. So in his teachings, there's a lot of stuff to do with Dzogchen, yeah, the practice, a formless practice in Tibetan tradition. And all its masters, if you read them, they tend to be all-rounders. Padmasambhava's story, he learns everything. He goes around India and he gets this teaching of Buddhism, that teaching, the other teaching, and he goes and learns how to make shoes from somebody and how to become a doctor and how to become this, that, how to write, all these things that these different scholars and different practitioners and different craftsmen could teach, you know, how to irrigate water. He learned everything. You know. Got involved in all sorts of things. Deep meditation, temple building, politics, exorcising demons. As Dujom Rinpoche quotes Padmasambhava saying, my view is higher than the sky, but my attention to actions and results is finer than flower. Profundities need a profound mind and heart, yeah. And you cultivate a profound mind and heart through ethics, meditation, wisdom. You ground yourself in the basics. Do you all know Miro, Juan Miro, the painter? You get these squiggly drawings, you look closer, they're people. And they've got big feet. He grew up, wasn't quite a peasant, but father had a farm, and the big feet on the ground, and then the body goes up, and everything's there, the genitals, the arms, all the bits, sometimes innards and things happening. Then the eyes are up amongst the stars. Yeah. And that is a Buddhist practice. The feet are on the ground, everything's present and correct, and the head is in the stars. And he always talks about that, about if you want to reach into the sky, if you want to reach into what's profound, you have to have your feet firmly in the ground. He's quite a quiet guy, Miro. He lived in the same studio as absolute nutters, like, what's his name, Dali, and all the other surrealists. It's going to be absolutely crazy. He'd just quietly be painting away. I think he used to work 9 to 5. He had a studio eventually when he got back to Mallorca and kind of worked there. And he had a little lock on his door, yeah, so his grandchildren didn't come in and disturb him. So basically a homely guy who did these amazing paintings, yeah, with his feet in the ground and the eyes amongst the stars. And that is some of these figures you come across in this tradition. Patril Rinpoche, yeah, really strong teacher of this tradition of Dzogchen meditation. He went around with a copy of the Bodhicharya Avatara and taught that over and over and over again. This is a book that focuses on compassion and other regarding. When he died, all he had was a bowl, the robes he was lying in, and this book. There's a story of him, the version I heard, I'll tell that one. He's on a journey and he looks like a beggar. He's got these tattered robes. and he's going on this journey, and people would travel in Tibet in large numbers because there's so many bandits that you went on your own, you were finished. It was like the Wild West, you know, you'd be done in. So he went in large numbers, and he went along with his family, and he looked after the kids, and he made the tea, and tidied up after everybody, and they thought this beggar's come along, so they could feed him, you know, as they went. He was doing his bit back. And then they arrived in the town, and he disappeared. He said, I've got to go and do something. It's been nice travelling with you. You know? And he said goodbye to all the kids and everything. And then they decided they're going to meet this great Lama and hear this Lama up on a high throne giving a teaching. And they go the next day to the temple, and there he is on the throne. This guy who'd been looking after them and making them tea. So that's Patro Rinpoche. Dilbo Khyentse, one of Sangharakshita's teachers, he spent 20 years in solitary. And he got married in the middle of that and had children, but stayed in solitary and meditated. When Sangharakshita last saw him, Sangharakshita was moved to the west. He was living, and he was Eastern Tibetan, so he was 6'6", and a wife equally tall, and two daughters taller probably, yeah, living in a little shed in Kalimpong. It was all they could afford to put, and Sangharakshita went to get his blessings and said cheerio to him because he was going back to London. And Dilbo Khyentse really wanted to give him something, and he looked around as a present, and all he had was the bread knife, an ornamental handle, and I think it's one of Sangharakshita's treasured possessions to this day. But by 20 years later, he had this huge monastery at the time of his death, which is up a lane in Kathmandu. You've got this little grubby lane round a corner through this gate, and suddenly this 3 or 4 story, like enormous, you know, it's an enormous institution built, and that takes ability. That takes ability to be a politician, to handle Nepalese government and all the things necessary, a businessman to get the money together for that. Yeah, negotiator to make the right connections that's going to give you the money. And there he was. So he's a diplomat, a businessman, a ritual master, a teacher, and a father. And it's like one of us being a chairman of several FNWOs, maybe Glasgow, Edinburgh, and Dánacóisí, and a few more, and doing lots of solitary meditation, and leading Buddha field festivals, conversing in fine points of the Dharma and study retreats and courses, ordaining people, raising a family, and having time left over for getting involved in engaged Buddhism, yeah, out protesting and getting involved in politics as well. It's like that in our world. And it's the same with other teachers that Sangharakshita met and studied with in Kalimpong, Dudjom Rinpoche, Chatro Rinpoche. You can find all that out in Precious Teachers in the book. So the Dzogchen tradition is about you build an intense devotion to teachers. It's not just a technique, a formless meditation technique in isolation. It is deeply emotionally connected with the people you learn from, and that tradition going right back. And Pamasamva, the practice of Pamasamva, is that. It's you looking to your teacher, through your teacher, to the tradition. Here's the picture in the hall of a Dakini. And that's what you become in the practice. You become this naked, red, passionate woman, drinking blood out of a skull cup, offering yourself completely freely and openly to the principle of the Dharma that's embodied, not in an abstract sense, but in the form of a being, the form of Pamasamva. So if you look at your teacher deep enough for that moment, what you gain from them, then that is Paramasamba. So we limit Buddhism in the West. For the last 200 years or 150 years, it's been, is it a religion or a philosophy? That's how Westerners have limited Buddhism. So you have, I always think it's about like a Jewish chap, that joke, a Jewish chap going through Belfast, and the gang comes up to him and says, are you a Protestant or a Catholic? And he goes, oh, I'm Jewish, actually. Yeah, but a Protestant, a Catholic Jew. And he's like, is Buddhism a religion or a philosophy? It's the same dilemma. But it's been modified. We've got modern ways of limiting it, haven't we? So I'm thinking of a couple here. Interfaith and therapy. Yeah. Now, these are great things. And when I talk about this, I don't mean they're rubbish and I'm poo-pooing them and I'm superior and they're terrible. These are good things. Yeah. It's good to teach children about different religions. It's good to build an importance, build a tolerant society. As Buddhists, we're not in isolation. We're living and practicing in a much wider world. Yeah? I go home, I pass churches and mosques, and this is 20 minutes. Yeah? I'm living in a very complex society. And we need to relate with that, yeah? And be a part of just encouraging respect for everybody. But it can, the approach can reduce the different traditions down to options, down to lifestyle choices. Yeah? So you've got a shelf, and a horizontal row, and the only criterion is your choice, your taste, like buying beans off the Safeway shelf, yeah? The individual's choice. I think I was talking to Mitra Kavinas with somebody, I think it was at the LBC or was it Sheffield, they were saying that a panel of teachers who've been teaching religious education were speaking to somebody, came to the centre and were speaking to him, and they wanted to know what offends Buddhists, and they kept asking the question in different ways. And typical FDW Buddhists is like, well, we don't take offence. Offence itself is an unskillful state of mind, and you say all that, but they're really waiting. And they, well, I suppose if you, I don't know, did this, and then they wrote it down. So they're waiting for someone to put in that box, like, what does this religion take offence with? Yeah. And the danger of a superficial relation to different religions is you have, you know, what do you worship? Who do you, you know, have a different casket, what do you pray to? Yeah. Rather than realising that each religion is very different, and there are very different ways of even putting the boxes together, let alone what you put in them. Yeah. Very different ways of thinking about that. And so we tend, this way, a multicultural society, we can see it a bit like a DIY shelf, all different tins of paint. And you go through the Dulux catalogue and you have the Tuscan scheme, the tropical, cool spring. Yeah. Can I have one in Manhattan or Brigadoon? Yeah. I like Tibetan theme, but do you have it in something other than maroon? Maroon's not quite my skin tone. You know? I like all this devotion stuff. I'm not sure about that. You know, or can I have a Theravadan without the celibacy? Is that possible? I like the yellow and I like simplicity, but you know, so it can be a bit like that, choosing our own colour scheme. With the therapy one is therapy is good too. If you're suffering, you need a cure. It can't be ignored. Yeah, anything goes. Whatever gets you out of the dilemma, do it. Yeah. From wherever you get it from. But in terms of Buddhism, just seeing Buddhism just as therapy can reduce the Buddha's dharma back into little boxes. Yeah? And the boxes here are on shelves, this time at Boots, not the DIY shop. Yeah? Little practices become little boxes of little things, actions you can do, techniques you can do in order to cure a limited end. So it's a technique of a limited use for a limited, if necessary, end. The dharma in its entirety addresses a whole different order of disease, one the most healthy, well-adjusted individual suffers from as much as anybody else. I'm not going to sing this. Van Morrison's song, right? When you got a headache, a little powder will soothe the pain. Go right back to sleep and you'll feel all right again. When you got a backache, a little rubbing will see you through. When you got a heartache, there ain't nothing you can do. Electric lights go out, candlelight will see you through. When you got a heartache, there ain't nothing you can do. Yeah. Dukkha, yeah. Dukkha in its depths is our underlying existential heartache. It's got no cure in a straightforward, ordinary sense. There ain't nothing you can do on this level of body sensation and psychology. Only complete and perfect awakening will do. So we destroy the Dharma by dismissing it. Yeah. By closing our heart to its totality, its depth, its potential, and hence closing ourselves to our depth and potential. It's a mirror, a gateway, it's something you work at. And the open heart is receptive to, the open heart is receptive to life itself. Dharma is a mirror for life. A mirror of something incomparably bigger than we are. And you can't integrate the Dharma, insight into reality, into your everyday life. If you do, if you can, what you can grasp isn't the Dharma. I was reading Nga Wang Zangpo, I think he's a Westerner, but he's writing stuff on Padmasambhava that I was reading up for. And it made me realise, when did it become a buzzword about integrating things into your everyday life? But it is, isn't it? It's not a buzzword. And he says, we don't talk about integrating a serious disease into our lives, or a love affair, or a death of someone close to us, or of a new child, or something like that. Yeah? Or even winning a lottery. We don't talk about all that being integrated into ordinary lives, do we? Yeah? Yet, we want to integrate the Dharma into ordinary lives. Take it in our terms, and have it in our lives unchanged. And if you read all the accounts, all the biographies down the years of people who have gained insight, yeah, realisation is more cataclysmic than any of these. So Padmasambhava sits there, and you must go to him. You must open up. You must open up into a level of metta openness, the open heart, and then you're over the barrier. Otherwise, the wall is impenetrable. No cannibals need enter, need apply. So engaging with the guru, yeah? Padmasambhava's pure land, this here, embodies a ceaseless creative tension an interplay between our ideals, the beauty of compassion and wisdom, and our actual experience. Yeah? All the irritations, all the weaknesses, all the inadequacies. Yeah? This represents that meeting point between the beauty of the ideal we want and our actual experience. Buddhist practice is meant to feel awkward.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah? So we're attracted to it to solve our problems. That's what we're after. Yeah? It says, end of suffering on the tin, doesn't it? And that's what we go for. Here we come. And it does in a way, but in a way, in a sense, a subtle sense, that unease doesn't end. You've noticed by now that the practice focuses more and more on a particular problem. Yeah? The Zen tradition of the koan, it just gets bigger and bigger in a way. There is relief, there is ease, there is joy comes out of it all. At the same time, we're still in a bit of a pickle, aren't we? We keep discovering deeper and deeper implications. The Dharma gets in there and it stirs you up. Maybe that's the other talk, that's a talk about Pamasana, stirring up the demons. And if you get right into the Dharma, it won't let you off the hook. You know? What was it Chogyam Trungpa says? Best not to start it. If you started it, best to keep going to the end, because you can never get off. Because
yeah.
You can't get everything back in the case. Yeah. Things have expanded. Life has become richer, fuller, probably a bit trickier and more complicated, but fuller, and it won't go back in the box, really. Some of these little things you take out and put in water and turn to flowers. Don't yeah. So, must get it back in the box, must get it flat again. Nope, you've got to keep going. You've started. So, metta, example. Difficult person stage, right? All of Buddhism is in the fourth stage of the metta bhavana. You sit with the honesty of how you actually feel. Don't like this person. Nope, the dog's got the hackles up. Yeah. Hate, irritation. At the same time, you wish to be kinder, more loving, calmer. Yeah. At the same time, you have really strong values and ideals. Yeah. You know you can do better than hating this person. You know there's more to life than all these tiresome irritations and gripes. Yeah. So there's two opt-outs. You're in a tension. You're in a horns of a dilemma. One, option one, pretend you're nice and kind already. Yeah. Steer to the shallow and the inane. If you're a certain temperament, you can manage that. Go, that's nice. Yeah. Something else, I have myself boxed within. I should be like this. I should be like that. It's a lot less pleasant than being inane. But it's both a kind of, you're overwhelmed by the ideal and you've lost touch with experience. Or you go for the experience, don't you? Really give in to the hate, reinforce it and be run by it. Yeah. Sitting in the awkwardness of holding both the honesty and your values. Sitting in the open confusion beyond the cannibal sorted out tyranny is the cutting edge of the practice. This is the pure land of Padmasambhava. So it's an openness where something new can arise. Yeah? And in this light, the awkward feeling you're feeling is called growth. Yeah? It's called change. And contrary to some popular views, it's good to feel a wee bit awkward, uneasy, even stressed. But awkward, uneasy, even stressed, and I'm putting bold, in the right way. That's very important. Feel the awkwardness and do it anyway, to paraphrase Susan Jeffers. So being too comfortable is spiritual death, isn't it? It's the God realm, if we're lucky, in the wheel of life. And cultivating a deeper and deeper taste for openness and this fresh, untrammeled life that is that confusion, isn't that cutting edge? Engaging with the Dharma is taking on a sense of values beyond the complexities of your raw experience. It's not enough just to sit with your raw experience, but you're taking on a complexity, a movement to something more. You're not just sitting blankly with your experience, but you're orienting yourself more and more towards a positive. Metta isn't a feeling, isn't a static state, it is an intention. Yeah? You're cultivating an intention, and that moves you forward into dynamic growth. That's that enlightening momentum I was talking about. It's not basking in good feelings. Opening towards our potential, not grasping the past or trying to fix the present. And we embody our intentions more and more until we become them, until every movement is imbued with them, yeah? Until you are Padmasambhava. Yeah? Your very experience is a palace of lotus light. This very place, the lotus paradise, this very body, the Buddha. That's hackering again. So Padmasambhava's palace is the sense of values right in the middle. uncompromising values of another way of being, of living out of metta, living out of kindness, living out of rallying every being. Yeah, uncompromising amongst the cannibals. It's a lotus that blooms in the midst of the flames. And his activity, all these stories you get in him dancing around, charging around, taking on the demons and tyrants, is a dynamic practice at the cutting edge between the ideal and the chaos of experience. That very gap, that's where you find him. It's not a quick fix patch. Paramasambhava sits in that creative space, cherishing the awkwardness, dancing with it, working and playing with it. And that's embodied with the Dakini. It's very inclusive, because it's got male and female Dakinis, Dakas and Dakinis. And Dakinis are kind of original witches that eat people as well, but they've been converted into the energy, the dynamic energy, when fear, rather than being ignored, becomes vitality and life. You know? They hang out in cremation grounds, and they either eat the meditators that aren't quite up to it, and support the ones that are. But that's your energy, isn't it? That's what you meet, either in the devouring sense, or in the helping sense. And finally, Paramasambhava doesn't just sit safely behind the battlements. He's got a rainbow bridge, and he's marching out with attendants to go and sort out the demons. And there he is, he's built a little temple in the demons, in the cannibals' land. And he's got tormas and shrines and meditation cushions, and he's busy teaching away there. It's an ever-widening circle that the Sangha grows. So I'll end off with just talking about, you know, I've talked all the talking about, I'm going to read. The man himself, Paramasambhava, sums it all up. Vain arrogance excites the malevolence of others. To break one's relationship with a teacher causes adulteration. Acting to please others, rather than as one should, is to sell the precious doctrine. Let these three expressions, I do not have, I do not understand, I do not know, be repeated over and over again. That is the heart of my advice. Murmur, clamour, quarrel coming, certainty, courage, confidence lacking. Do not say what is right or wrong until you know for sure. When delicacies are given to men, they end by vomiting them. But sacred advice does not let you down. These are words from my heart. That's it.